Good morning, everyone. We'd like to welcome you to the City Council study session for the morning of October the 10th. Councilmember Duff is out of town and excused from this meeting. The first item on our agenda is to discuss and hear an update on Mesa's 2020 Census Task Force and the United States 2020 Census and take action on reducing the number of members appointed to the task force by 5 from 24 to 19 and appointing one new member to the task force. We'd like to welcome members of the city staff and the task force that are here today to help us know what we can do to help with this project. Jeff?
Mayor, Council.
I don't think, there we go. There we go, now I got sound. Mayor, Council, it's a pleasure to be with you today. My name is Jeff Robbins. I'm your 2020 Census Administrator. I'm joined here today with Haley Smith, who's a Management Analyst here at the city, and Abby Atanal Rodriguez, who represents Mesa Community College and the Phi Theta Kappa Honor Society. She's the president of that group at Mesa Community College. We prepared the information today to help you as a council to be more informed about the efforts that are going in at the national, regional, and local level. And you may have also noticed that there's a lot of slides in the slide deck, but we're going to move through these pretty quickly. So we'll start off with what's going on at the national level. The National Census Bureau, they have adopted the tagline, "Shape your future, start here." And in Spanish, "Dale forma a tu futuro, empieza aquí." And these two taglines will be on most of our marketing material at the regional and the local level so that we can maintain continuity with the national campaign. Last time I came and presented to you, there was two main issues that we were following closely. One was the citizenship question, and the other was the funding for the census effort at the national level. And the first has been resolved. There will be no citizenship question on the 2020 census, meaning that residents will not be asked if this person is a citizen of the United States. And then in August, Congress allocated about $600 billion in a two-year funding deal, and $2.5 billion of that was allocated for the census, and the Bureau has indicated that they feel that closes their funding gap, and they're confident that they will have an effective campaign in 2020. They have also released a draft of the form that residents will receive here in Mesa. And we're not going to go through the entire form today, but I just wanted to give you a look of what your residents are going to receive in the mail. And again, this is a good place to mention that for the first time ever, this will be translated into a digital form for an online response option and for a phone response option. And so these are really game changers. We've never had these before, and it makes sense in a digital age that we should be able to do that. There's 10 questions in 10 minutes, and it kind of varies depending on how many kids you have. If you have lots of kids, it takes a little bit longer, or their dependents in the home. But it's a pretty quick form to fill out, should be pretty painless, and has a huge impact on the city. This is a draft schedule, and from what we've heard, this is set now, and they're going to go forward with this. Mesa residents can begin responding to the census on March 12th, 2020. And the main takeaway from this slide isn't to remember all of the dates. It's that residents will be contacted up to 5 times before somebody comes out and knocks their door. So they'll receive a series of postcards and letters, and they're slightly different. The letters have a unique identification code in them, and this is important for responding. And so they'll take that unique identifier, which is tied to the location of their residence, and then they will either go online, or they'll do the phone response, or the internet, or the paper form, and they'll insert that code there. Now, one of the questions that we've received at our public tabling events is, what happens if I lose that code? And the answer to that is that they can still go online and enter their address, and that will also be accepted. It just won't be accepted on the paper form. So it's a rather important code. They should try to save that when they do the response. But if they lose it, they can still respond to the census. This is a simpler schedule, and I think this is how I think about it. It's a little easier to think about, is that in March, all residents in Mesa will be invited to respond online. If they don't respond online, then they can respond in April by a paper form, which will be sent to them. If they haven't responded to either the online form or the paper form, that's when enumerators come out and knock their door. And again, an enumerator is somebody who works for the Census Bureau who comes out and will ask for their information on site. And so a lot of people don't want enumerators coming to their door. And so what we always say is, if you don't want somebody coming to your door, just fill out the form and nobody will come to your door. You won't get any more mail about it. It's just done. So if you don't want to be bothered, just respond online. We also want to make council and the residents of Mesa aware of another operation that will be happening that's related to the census, but it's on a different timeline, and that's the group quarters operation. Group quarters, I met a gentleman out at Eastmark about a week ago, and he said that he lived in an assisted care facility, so how should he respond? And it was a great question because he's counted a little bit differently. If you live in a place like a dorm or a group quarters, I call like a assisted living facility or a prison, some place that's managed by some management organization, typically those are counted by a different way, and that's because a census enumerator will come out, work with the facility management to count everybody in there instead of having everybody there respond on their own. So transitory location enumeration, that refers specifically to campgrounds and RV parks. Well, we have a lot of RV parks in Mesa. So at those RV parks, they don't need to respond individually to the census. They will have somebody come out to that location and they'll work with the staff overseeing the RV park to do the count. And the service-based enumeration, that refers to those who are unhoused in Mesa. So like Paz de Cristo, they will have somebody come out from the census and count everybody who's in that facility. So the high-level summary is that the vast majority of Masons should plan to respond to the census using the online form, the phone response, or the paper mailer. But if you live in a unit that is managed by some kind of management company, not a traditional apartment, but something like an RV park, or it's like a dorm, you don't respond, somebody will come out and you'll be counted a different way. Hopefully that makes sense. The 2020 census will also be held in more languages than ever before, which we're really excited about. Only English and Spanish mailers have been printed, and that's pretty standard. The Census Bureau uses a formula to determine which tracts are predominantly Spanish-speaking, and they will be sent the English and the Spanish mailer. Otherwise, you'll just get an English mailer. But on that mailer, in 13 languages, there'll be another paragraph that says, so for example, if I spoke Tagalog, there'll be a paragraph on that mailer that says, in Tagalog, please go to this web address, or to, you can call this number and you can speak to somebody who speaks Tagalog and they'll walk you through this form. So again, up to 13 languages are supported either by internet or by phone. And if we have Mesa residents, and I know we do, that don't speak any of the 13 predominant languages, they may speak a very minor language, then they have an instructional guide that will be mailed out in that mailer that will help them walk them through that as well. So it should be pretty easy for every resident, no matter what language they speak, to respond to the census. So what's going on at the regional level? We are part, the city of Mesa, I should say, is part of a regional campaign through the Maricopa Association of Governments. It's a $2 million campaign. We have hired Reister, which is a nationally known firm, to run this media campaign. And they are distributing information about the census, specifically about the Maricopa County area, through a number of different mediums. This is a screenshot of the website, our iCount 2020. That's our regional campaign tagline, our iCount 2020 website. And on the Mesa website, we do have a landing page. We are directing a lot of traffic to this regional page. It's very well done, and anybody can go visit it right now. And the website address is www.icount2020.info. And I tried it this morning with .com, and it didn't work. So remember, it's .info, not .com. This is our local tagline. We've adopted the regional one, iCount2020, but we customized it so that it's just about Mesa. So we have the little Mesa AZ below there. And so wherever we have the national tagline, we're going to have this local tagline along with it. And we're excited to talk to you about what we're doing at the local level, because we have a lot of very interesting initiatives. Councilmember Heredia has been the chairman and has just done a great job with our task force. We have so many fantastic local partners that have been helping to form this campaign. This is a picture of the task force, and we all look a little tired, but give us some slack. It had been at the end of a three-hour meeting, so we were tired. This is a shot of our strategy board, and I included this because the task force has been very meticulous in how they have approached this, very methodical. And so we break out how we're doing what quarter, and it's very well thought out and planned, and we're trying to make sure we get the biggest ROI we can on the investment of resources. This is a map of Mesa, and if you kind of want to locate yourself on the map, the green is the western edge of the city, and the purple there is along the 60, so we're kind of in the western half of the city. And these are driven from data that we pulled from the 2010 campaign. And so we went down to the tract level and said, okay, what was the response rate in this tract? And from that, we're predicting which tracts are going to have a lower response rate. And I want to emphasize, it does not mean that we're only going to focus and use our resources in just these tracts. In fact, we've done events out in Northeast Mesa and Southeast Mesa, and we will continue to do those, but we are giving a special emphasis and thought to these particular tracts that have had a historically low response rate. Our strategy as a task force is we have a six-pronged approach. We have an ambassador program, which I'll have Abby talk about in a moment here. We have local champions. Any Mesa resident that wants to can be a local champion. That's somebody who volunteers to receive information and media from us at the task force and then to share that with their neighbors and friends. That is the linchpin in this whole thing, is having trusted voices, at the local level that will stand up and help share with their members of their community why this is so important. We also have a focus at events, which I'll show you our tent in a moment. We have a very strong digital engagement campaign, and we are tying that in with our local champions so that when somebody takes the pledge, we will create digital content, send it to them so they don't have to come up with their own. All they have to do is repost it, just amplify it. It's really easy to do, and it's a great way to support the community. We also want to make all of our messaging very relevant to locals. So we want to focus on that every single Mesa resident that is counted, the estimated state and federal benefit that comes to the city is $3,195. And so we hammer that home nonstop when we're out in the community, because most people don't know just how much funding is tied to population. So many of the formulas that are used at the national level are tied to a population count. And so it really can make a difference on the quality of life of our community. So it's so important. And then the census pledge, which we'll show you in a minute, that's one of our call to action tools. The way our messaging works is the task force comes up with the directive and the strategy. They then feed that strategy to the ambassador program and to our digital engagement content, which then goes to our local champions, and our local champions spread that to our community members. And all of that is to improve our self-response rate here in the city. So Abby, I'll turn it over to you.
Mayor, council members, I would like to begin by saying it's an honor to be here with you and to partner with the City of Mesa with the Census Project. I represent Phi Theta Kappa. Phi Theta Kappa is the International Honor Society for all two-year colleges, and currently I serve as the chapter president at Mesa Community College Omicron Beta Chapter. One of the programs that makes this organization particularly amazing is it challenges its members to take part of a research and community service project, which we call Honors in Action. This year, our team has dedicated all of their work into the census and impacting our local community. We're excited to be focusing on educating our community members at community events. We recently just kicked off our census, our portion of the census work, and have received over 300 pledges. Our initial goal was 500 pledges, so we will be making that goal really soon. Additionally, we're also tasked with creating engaging media on social media. Currently, we are working on creating a social media ambassador team, which will be dedicated towards making engaging, fun, and informational sources about the census. Overall, we're thrilled to work in our community, to serve our community in a way that will impact our portion of the world for the next 10 years.
So Abby didn't say it, but I'll go ahead and toot their horn. These students are absolutely amazing. They have changed the dynamic of this campaign, and I've had universities reach out to me. I've had other cities reach out to me trying to mimic what we're doing here. We have copied a lot of the best tactics across the nation, but this is one that's homegrown. And this partnership, they are our boots on the ground. They're so engaging, and we just love working with these students and our partnership with Mesa Community College. So thank you, Abby, for amazing leadership. It's really just great leadership and being able to work with you in the school. We are also going out to our communities all the time, to business groups, schools, nonprofits, HOAs. If in your districts you have groups that are organized and they'd be willing to have us come out and talk to them a little about the census and have them engage, just let us know when and where, and we'll make sure we're there. This is a copy of our pledge that we hand out. This is the paper copy. We also have a digital copy, and digital version, I should say. And it's in Spanish and in English. And it's encouraging them to give us just their email address, and we'll stay in contact with them so that they can promote the content for the census. And as you can see, it's catching on. We are, Abby mentioned, we have hundreds of people taking the pledge, and it's really doing exactly what we intended it to do as a task force.
Mayor and Council, the second component of the pledge campaign is the text to pledge. And we recognize that in today's world, texting is easy. And so we wanted to make it as easy as possible for our residents to pledge to take the U.S. Census. And we also wanted to give people options. They can pledge on paper, or they can pledge by texting. And so to pledge, our residents will text the number 22828, and they will either text Mesa Pledge for information in English, or Promesa for information in Spanish. And Promesa means promise in Spanish, so they're promising to complete the U.S. Census. And so when residents text this number, they'll receive an official link to the census when it is live. And as Jeff mentioned, they'll also receive content that they can share on social media. And they'll receive that content in the language that they texted. So if they texted Mesa Pledge, they'll receive content in English. And if they text ProMesa, they'll receive content in Spanish. And so to market this information and this text to pledge campaign, we're going to be partnering with businesses to have them distribute our text to pledge marketing material. And we also want to utilize any existing city resources that we have to spread awareness, like putting information about texting to pledge in utility mailers or on the side of City of Mesa vehicles.
And here's a shot of our tent. So you'll see that it's at all of our events. And again, you'll notice it's bilingual. We've got in the backdrop there, we've got one side that's in Spanish, one side that's in English. And the valence here, it's in English, but on the other side, it's in Spanish. So we want to make sure we're reaching out to every single resident. We also have this fun Mesa Pledge wall. It's kind of hard to see with the glare, but at the top of this wall, it says, "What would you do with $3,195? And we'll be totally honest, this was a draw. The census, it's not the most interesting content to some people, and so we had to bring them in. So we bring them in with this wall, and they can put, you know, whatever they want, their dreams, their hopes up on this wall with what they do with just a grant of this money. And while they're there, we can kind of talk to them about the census and why it's important and why $3,195 is on that board. So it's been very effective, and it's a glow-in-the-dark chalk, and so we have a black light, and that thing just lights up at night. It makes it a really fun draw at events.
Another key component of a successful Census 2020 campaign is a partnership with Mesa Public Library. And this partnership is key for four main reasons. First, our libraries are in close proximity to our target population. Second, they interact with a lot of City of Mesa residents. Mesa Public Library had over 1 million visitors in this last fiscal year. The third reason, as Jeff mentioned, this is the first time in history that the U.S. Census can be completed online. And so our libraries have internet access, and they have computers, making them a prime location for our residents to come and complete the census at the library. And the last reason is that the staff at the library are seen as trusted messengers to people in the public. And so the public comes to them for information, and then they trust what they have to say. So what's the plan? The plan is to have the libraries distribute our iCount 2020 marketing materials. And we're actively working with Mesa Public Library right now to determine the best way to market the census and the best way to make it as easy as possible for our residents to complete the census at the library. So when people walk into the library, we want them to know that, first off, this is a place where they can take the census because there's marketing materials everywhere. And second, right where they need to go to take the census because those computer areas are activated and they have marketing materials all over them. And we're also exploring other options right now with other libraries, like the library at Mesa Community College. And so if there's a location in your district that has public computers that you would like people to know they can complete the census at, please let us know, and we would love to get that location the marketing materials that they need. And another important part of this plan is that since staff at the library are trusted messengers, we want to make sure that they are prepared to share the importance of completing the U.S. Census and that they can answer any of the frequently asked questions.
So at our last task force meeting, we wrote down what we were going to do, who was going to do it, and when we were going to do it. So Councilmember Heredia, you had written down engage council members, and we thought, gosh, it's already October, so I'll help you out with this one. And we'll talk about the three ways that the Mesa City Council can help us in this effort. And the first is that you're always out in your community. You're very engaged as a council. And so when you're at any meeting that involves Mesa residents, talk about the census. When you talk about something, the residents know it's important, and so they'll follow your lead, and they'll be able to, again, share that with their neighbors and friends. When you're talking to the members of your community, make sure to make it relevant to them. Why does it matter? It matters because we get state shared revenues in the form of about $330 per person, and that's general fund money for the most part that goes and supports critical services and our public safety. And at the federal level, it supports roads, it supports our highway construction and planning, Title I schools, the National Breakfast Program, the National Lunch Program at our schools, Medicaid, Medicare Part B, so healthcare. It's every facet of what makes our community great is supported by this funding. And then we will be sharing with you very soon little cards that you can take at events that have a little brief snippet about the census, and then also that text a pledge campaign number that Haley talked about, so that they can right there take that pledge and become a local champion. So at that point, we will conclude and open up for any questions you might have. And I believe we also have to take a vote on reorganizing our task force.
Great. Thank you. Great presentation. Council, questions? Let's start with Mr. Luna.
Jeff, thank you for attending Food Truck Friday. Does your son come when we invite you to come? Because he did these balloon things, and he was a real hit at Food Truck Friday.
Yes, Cooper the Magnificent is very excited to come to another show and do his balloon animals.
Yeah. And also, the ambassadors were incredible. And I had to tell them, okay, it's okay, you can go, because it was almost 9 o'clock, and they didn't want to go. They wanted to make sure that they were present, so... So thank you for doing that. I have four scheduled events at the end of this month, beginning of November. So I think we've reached out to you. So we want you to come back.
All right, we'll be there.
Mr. Thompson.
Jeff, thank you guys for the presentation. Thanks for coming out to eSmart last week and speaking. Got a sinus infection I'm getting over, so I got my Barry White voice going. So bear with me. But, and this is a big deal for Mesa, and I don't necessarily know if our citizens realize how big of a deal it is, but especially when you look at District 6 and how it's grown since 2010, you think back to 2010 and Eastmark was still just a vacant piece of land called the GM Proving Grounds. You know, most of Bella Via wasn't even built at the time, and I can think of many, many other subdivisions that weren't built, and so there's probably at least another... You know, maybe 80,000 people minimum that have come into Southeast Mesa since 2010. And so it's a big deal when you start looking at the revenue, the shared revenue that can come back to Mesa, as well as the potential for a new congressional representation in D.C. and what that means to our city as well, and potentially legislatively positions also that can carry our water for us. So thank you for getting out ahead of this. And Frankie, thank you for chairing this committee. It's a big deal for Mesa.
Jeff, you mentioned something about the Title I schools. What are you doing in terms of working with our surrounding school districts to let their parents, make sure that their parents know that this is important, that they fill out the census form, because our schools are dependent on the federal funds that we do get. So what are you doing there?
Mayor, Councilmember Luna, we have met with MPS, and we actually have one of their leadership members on our task force. So we knew right away that they were a linchpin. They're very important in this process. We are coordinating different media deployment with them, especially after November, after their bond election. And we will be working, they have a they have a few different ways of deploying information throughout their system. One is Peach Jar, and they have volunteered to allow us to use that to get information out. And we are also constantly feeding them different videos and things. They said that that really responds well with the kids. The kids get that and they stay engaged. And so, and then we also have a counterpart at the regional level. I shouldn't say regional, they're national. They work for the, directly for the Census Bureau. They work with all of the school districts in the Valley. And she has been partnering closely with me and with the school district in making sure that they have a vibrant campaign and that we're using everything we can in the Mesa School District.
Mr. Thompson.
One other thing. One of the items on here is talking about your reduction of the task force by five. Why are we reducing the numbers on the task force? Just real quick. I didn't see it in the council reports. I'm just kind of curious.
Mayor, Councilmember Thompson, the reason we're reducing the number, a lot of these people who have volunteered to be on the task force, they're leaders in their organizations, they're very busy, and so we've had a few that through just life challenges haven't been able to attend, and so it's been sometimes difficult to make quorum, and because this is a task force appointed by council, we have to always make sure that we are meeting quorum, and so a lot of them said, you know, I support the effort, continue to send me information, but I just can't attend. And so we are reducing that number. And where we could, we asked them to name a replacement. And for example, with the Chamber of Commerce, we are replacing a member there and making sure that they're staying involved.
Thank you. Frankie.
And I think also just to your question, Kevin, we started with a lot of people. And so our quorum was just getting a little tighter and tighter every meeting that we had. But, you know, it's, the folks that have attended, have been great, giving us resources and then ideas on how to reach out to their networks. So it's been great working together with, you know, it's a myriad of different networks that we appointed to this task force, from faith-based businesses, school districts. You know, Gilbert is also on it. We're working with other school districts that encompass here in the city of Mesa. So, our folks are really providing some great ideas and outreach potential to get ready for this. But I also quickly mention there is a Mesa census, there is a census office in Mesa that is going to open up or already starting to open up on Power, I believe, right, Jeff?
Yes, Mayor, Councilmember Heredia, that is accurate. We do have a regional office. It's one of their sub-sites. The main office is in Phoenix, but we do have an office there. They are recruiting, and I didn't put this in the PowerPoint, but gosh, they need thousands of people to work as enumerators and also to be at the office. There's office jobs there. We also have one of two processing sites in the entire nation in Phoenix that has full-time jobs throughout the end of 2020. And so if people are interested in those, they can either come to our website, go to the regional site. There's information on how to apply for those jobs.
Thank you. Mr. Freeman?
Thank you, Mayor. And Jeff and ladies, thank you for your work on this. I know it's really important. I was really on PowerPoint page 19, interested in the color-coded tracks or areas that those need additional helps and reach out. Is that correct?
Yes, Mayor, Councilmember Freeman, that is accurate. Again, we identified those using 2010 data, and there's a few maps that are put out, one by CUNY New York, another one by the Census Bureau, that are fantastic resources. And so we looked at the tracks that had very low response rates, and then we started grouping them by specific demographic information. So for example, there's a blue area down kind of center west Mesa. I'm not going to get the area exactly right, but that area was predominantly Latino and Spanish speaking, and so we grouped that together, and we have a kind of a sub strategy specifically for that area and for the other three areas that we identified as being of critical importance and where we can really make a difference in changing the response rate.
Yeah, so I was interested in that because some of that area is in my district, so I want to hold some planned community meetings, and I have some community meetings coming up that I will engage you in that conversation, so I appreciate knowing that. The other thing on number 25, I noticed several Mesa former employees in that picture, so good for them signing up and getting involved in there, so I appreciate their work. So yes, I'm going to engage you in our conversations and within my district and our community, and so I look forward to hearing from you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Councilmember Freeman. Vice Mayor, excuse me.
I have a quick question. The text to pledge campaign is really interesting to me. I mean, are we gathering? I get that just committing people to ultimately participate is a good idea, putting it on their radar, but are we gathering any data in the process of the text to pledge process that will assist us later in reaching out to the or identifying those people, or is there some strategy involved in this text to pledge campaign?
Well, I'll let Haley talk a little bit about that, and I'll answer you the question about the data. We made a tactical decision here to not ask for more data than we needed, specifically because we didn't want to scare people away. We didn't want them to feel like we were trying to find out everything about them. There is a lot of concern, a lot of fear sometimes about giving data away to anybody, especially the local government. And so we just asked for their name and their phone number, and that's all we're using to communicate with them. And then afterwards, we have committed that we are going to destroy that mailing list. We're only going to use it for census purposes so that they know that their information is not being held or used for any other purpose. And Haley, did you have anything you wanted to add about the text of pledge? She's over our text of pledge campaign.
Yeah, Mayor, I just wanted to say that the main goal of that is to make it easy for people. So it would be the same information that we would be collecting on those pledge cards as what we're collecting from the text to pledge campaign. So as Jeff said, just their name, and then we would have that number and their email, but then we'll be destroying all of that.
Okay, and I guess that was behind my question, is are people going to be uncomfortable? Do they, privacy and particularly email addresses, or maybe some of the sensitive questions that you answer when you're filling out the form, I just wonder if we were spooking people too early, or if maybe there was a reason for them to be spooked if we're getting some data, mining data early on, but that's not the case. Okay.
Well, Mayor, I can't speak to how everybody feels about it. I'm sure there's some people who don't even want to give us their email address, and that's completely fine. That is, that is their right. We did try to make it as limited as possible, and they don't even have to give us their last name. We just want a first name so we can address them in the email, and then their email address. They don't have to give us their phone number. If they want to, we can communicate them through text. It's an option. And so it's really up to them, to whatever they want to give us, if they want to give us anything at all, to help them stay informed. And one of the things we try and communicate when we do the text to pledge is that if you want accurate information about where to respond and when to respond, this is a great way for us to provide you accurate information from the Census Bureau. And so we're trying to provide it as a service and show people that there's a value behind giving us their email address.
So the bulk of the work is going to be done during the winter months when the weather is great in Mesa and our population swells. And it would seem like a common question that's going to be asked is, I'm here in my RV from Minnesota. Should I fill out the form here, or should I somehow, do I have an obligation to do it in where I came from? My general understanding, and correct me, is that if someone lives here 6 months, then they should correctly fill out the form here. But it seems like that's a question that's going to come up when we are talking to our winter visitors.
Yes, Mayor.
Enlighten us a little bit on that.
Yes, that's a great question, Mayor, and we do get that all the time. The general rule for when to respond and where to respond is, where do you spend most of your time? And so I'll respond to two issues I think you raised, Mayor. One was, if I'm a Canadian and I'm coming down, we have a lot of great Canadian visitors that aren't even nationals of the United States, but they spend a great amount of time here. Do they respond? And the answer is if they spend more than would be considered a short vacation here, living here, having an impact on our services and our resources, then they do respond to the census. And the second is if they're an RV just traveling around, well, there's a few different ways to handle that. If they spend, when they get the form, they should respond wherever they're at. And again, the RV specifically is a little bit different because that's with group quarters, so they wouldn't respond anyway. But let's just say it was somebody who had an itinerant lifestyle and they were just traveling around. One way that's handled is by census day, which is April 1st, 2020. And wherever that person is, doesn't matter if they're in Albuquerque or Ohio or wherever they're at, on census day, if they don't have a normal place and normal residence, that is where they are counted for the next 10 years. Even if they never come back to Mesa, the next day they take off, they never come back, they are counted wherever they're at on census day if they have an itinerant lifestyle.
I think that's important information. I think there's a lot of, when we're out sending enumerators into RV parks and winter visitor communities, I think people might choose not to participate when in fact they should. So I hope we can get that message out. Well, thank you for your good work. I was on the 2000 campaign, or maybe it was the 2010 campaign. I lose it now. So thank you. I know what a tireless job this is. And again, the thing to realize is this is $3,195 per year per person, and the impact of being undercounted lasts for 10 years. So really, this is a huge financial opportunity for the city of Mesa to accurately reflect the growth that's going on here, and it will have extreme repercussions for the next decade throughout our community. So thank you. I'm sorry. Jeremy, please.
I just had one comment. Jeff, I just want to say thanks for leading this up. Frankie, thank you for taking your time to lead this up, and everybody else who's participated in the process. I appreciate you guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Councilmember Whitaker.
Thank you. Any other questions or information on this? I think we do need a vote to modify the number of the task force. Is there a motion to that effect? Thank you, Mr. Luna and Mr. Thompson. And just to be clear, that's to change the number from 24 to 19, correct? all in favor? I'm sorry.
You and also in the same votes do the appointment?
Okay. We're appointing one new task force member, and that's the identity of that person is in the, do we need to make that? It's in the report. Okay. All right. I think we're clear on the motion. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. That passes unanimously. Thanks again for your great work on this very important project. We appreciate it. The next item on our agenda is 1B. That's to hear a presentation on citywide housing data, demographic data, and public input collected related to a draft housing master plan, and discuss and provide direction on guiding principles to be addressed within the master plan. Welcome. Another important topic.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. Ruth Giese, Community Services Director. With me today is Mr. Richard Mix. He is the person that helped us compile all the data that we collected in phase one, and so he's going to be here available for any specific questions that might come up. Also, Nana, our planning director, will be assisting us in the presentation today, and I have Andrea Alicote here, and she as well will be assisting. I wanted to make sure to thank Andrea, Ray Timish, Mary Brandon, and Emily Greco for all their work that they've done in compiling all of this today. So thank you. So with that, we're talking about the Housing Master Plan today. And we are going to be providing an overview of citywide housing data, demographic data, and the public input that we collected during these two phases. And then we're also going to be seeking input from Mayor and Council today to provide direction and approve the guiding principles that we're going to be using as a basis for constructing the goals and the strategies that will be addressed in the plan. So what is a housing master plan? We're in a unique position to form a vision that will serve as a guide for our growing and diverse population. This is a blueprint of how we will address the housing needs for our anticipated growth. The purpose and function of the Housing Master Plan is to ensure that there will be an adequate supply of housing to meet future demand, and this is a 20-year plan that coincides with our general plan. So as we look at the Housing Master Plan, it is important to know how it fits in with the overall general plan. So I've asked our planning director to give us a brief overview of that.
Mayor, Council, so as you may be aware, so the purpose of the general plan basically is the official document that sets the policy for how the city is going to grow, the physical development of the city. And it specifically lays out a vision of how and come up with strategies of how that vision can be achieved. In addition, it's required by both state law and in our city charter to have a comprehensive plan, which is a general plan. And specific element in the general plan is a housing plan, when the voters approved the general plan in 2014, one of the implementation tools was for us as a city to actually update our housing master plan. So this exercise is basically fulfilling the goals of the general plan that was established in 2014, and also basically responding to the needs of the community as we grow, how we were going to address the housing types. One of the major goals is for us to provide a variety of housing that will serve the various needs of the community. So that's all I have to add to it.
Thank you, Nana. So the housing master plan, as Nana said, is part of the general plan. And throughout this process, we wanted to make sure that the information that we were gathering was data-driven, that it incorporated with not only the general plan, but other city plans, including council priorities, regional and transit plans, and internal land use and economic development plans as well. We wanted to make sure we engaged the public through this process, and that we included expert analysis from a variety of stakeholders, community leaders, and staff. So this was a phased approach. So the first phase was our, as I said, our data and collection. We, Elliot Pollock and company, Rick Meeks, developed a historical context and foundation for us. He looked at the demographic characteristics of Mesa, the historical housing trends and current housing conditions. He also looked at federal funds use. How are we using our federal funds address our housing needs? And then what are some of the housing issues and challenges facing us as we move forward into the future? The second phase was really the public outreach campaign. We solicited in lots of various ways, and that included asking, you know, what are some of your goals and your objectives, and what do you think you would like to see as we develop this? The Housing and Community Development Board was also has provided input throughout the process and will be continued to be updated throughout the process as well. And then here we are today, beginning our third phase with the purpose of constructing the goals and the strategies of the plan based on the data collected from phase one and phase two and the guiding principles established by Mayor and Council. So phase one, we're going to first talk about our demographic analysis. So Mesa is home to about 500,000, as you well know. Based on 2015, the median income of our population is $49,177. This is 12% below the median of Maricopa County. And homeowner rates have declined from 66% in 2000 to 58% in 2015, primarily based from that housing crisis that we had. 33% of Mesa households are considered burdened by housing costs. And what that means is that they are paying more than 30% of their income on housing and utilities. 38.5% of our population is classified as low income or middle income, or moderate income, I mean, and 17% of that of our population is living in poverty. And just to give you an idea, the poverty level for a family of four is under $25,100. So if you have a mortgage of, let's say, 980, which is the median, although that keeps going up, then the family would have to earn $50,000 or $24 an hour in order to meet within that 30% threshold.
Got it. Yes, Jeremy.
Question: where's that data coming from that you just, all that stuff you just quoted?
Mr. Meeks.
data is from the U.S. Census, the American Community Survey, which is between the normal census, the census surveys, They provide that information every year. It lags a couple of years. Right now, the latest date is 2017.
Perfect. Thank you.
So the next area of focus is our housing inventory and our housing needs. Mesa's housing inventory is extensive, with more than 206,000 units. 175,000 of those are occupied. Based on population forecasts, this translates into a demand for approximately 30,000 new housing units, or an average of 3,000 new units per year through 2030. And the outlook for Mesa's housing market is positive, but we still do have some challenges, not unlike those facing other communities. We have to be able to be ready for our anticipated growth. We do have a good range of balanced of mixed housing options. That includes everything from executive housing, workforce housing, and affordable units. Although the affordable units area, that's where we, because of our population and the fact that we have a high population living in that low moderate income, that's where the major, most of our needs will be in the future. So because of that, and before we go to the next slide, I did want to also talk about our rent. Our vacancy rent rate is at an all-time low with 5%. So basically, anybody that needs to find something to rent, it's difficult. And if you're in that lower income bracket, it's even more difficult as rents are increasing, and we're seeing an average of 10% increase every year. And of note, when we were reviewing the housing stock in Mesa, 10% of our housing stock is manufactured housing. That's something that we want to look at in the future, because there's a growing number, over 38% of that housing stock is considered too old. And so we really are, one of the things that we're going to be looking at is that that type of housing in the future. So a brief review of our current federal funding programs to assist, how the city can assist with our growing housing needs. So as you all know, because you're our housing governing board as well, we have housing choice vouchers that are available for our for folks that need assistance. We have our home investment partnership program. This is where we can use our funds to build additional housing that we might need and work with nonprofits as well. We have our CDBG program, and we have our emergency solutions grant. That's for one-time emergency assistance for those that need it as well. So we have a variety of federal programs to assist for some of the housing needs looking into the future. We now want to go into phase two and talk a little bit about the public engagement process. So we had a campaign beginning in the fall of last year, 2018. We did quite a variety of things. One of the things we did is we did a web-based survey and marketing campaign. We actually got a really good response from that. Close to 1,200 folks actually took the survey. We did a think tank where we brought in housing experts as well as community members and staff members from various departments to really look at what kinds of things would you want to see in our master plan. We had community conversations. We had stakeholder meetings, specific stakeholder meetings, as well as staff working groups. So we really tried to look at lots of different ways to get input. What was interesting is that a lot of the values that we found that the community and the public were interested in really complemented the values that we have in the general plan that was also approved by the community. So it really complements the work that is being done with the general plan as well. So just a recap of some of the things that we found that through that public input process, existing neighborhoods to continue to uplift our older neighborhoods and look at ways to help folks to, you know, do any rehab or anything around our neighborhoods. With our new housing, do we have look at all different kinds of housing that serves all the needs of our residents? And is it tied to amenities, our beautiful parks and our transportation and our transit? We want to make sure that our housing ties and is connected to the things that the people need as well. And really look at making sure that this complements any land use or other zoning efforts that ties to the general plan. So everything that we saw really, we look to the general plan as well to continue, and we will take these into consideration when we come back to you with the goals and strategies as well. So that leads us to the guiding principles. This is where the area where we'd really like to seek input from you today. So these principles, again, the basis, overall vision statements, if you will, that would be part of our housing plan. And from this, what we're going to do is then we're going to come back to you and really develop those concrete goals and strategies in order to be successful with these principles. So it's to expand housing throughout Mesa for persons of all incomes and needs. To ensure the current inventory of housing is healthy, maintained, and safe. To prioritize federal funding housing strategies that include reducing homelessness and promoting home ownership. To seek partnerships to leverage housing development. And to ensure cohesiveness with the 2040 General Plan through strong internal partnerships. So this is our time to kind of get your input on those.
Great. Thank you very much. Council, questions for these folks? Mr. Luna.
Thank you, Ruth, for that presentation. One of my concerns is that we have manufactured homes that are in deplorable conditions in the city of Mesa. We don't want to get into a Mesa Rile situation again. What can we do as far as working with these communities to try to retrofit their housing or provide them opportunities? I think that's something that we need to consider as a council as we move forward with this plan.
Thank you, Mayor, Councilmember Luna. That was definitely one of the things that was brought up in phase one, that and one of the things identified was that we might have to do an additional survey that really looks into that segment of our housing stock, which is 10%, and then yes, 38% is over 38 years old. So what one of the things that we would do is to make sure that one of the strategies in the housing plan was to conduct a survey and also to look at ways that our current federal programs that we have in place, thinking outside the box, expanding those programs so that we can really look holistically at that type of housing. So it might be something where we combine our home ownership assistance program with getting that family, depending on what their income level is, to get out of that older house, maybe replace it, not maybe a brand new unit, but something that's more updated. And in the interim, we might use our voucher program to get them other housing while that's happening. So there's lots of potential areas where we can combine and really leverage our programs to assist in that effort.
Are we also working with the development community? We were very fortunate that we had Chicanos por la Causa. They came in, worked with the Mesa Royale community to rehab that whole facility. I think that's another thing that we need to consider as we move forward, because there are many, many manufactured homes throughout the city of Mesa. And if you drive through these parks, they're in deplorable condition, almost third world. And so we've got to do something to correct that, because we don't want to repeat what many of us experienced a few years ago.
Thank you, Mayor and Councilmember Luna. That would definitely be one of the strategies that we would include with leveraging some of those additional programs to continue what we've seen that's successful.
I know other council members have some questions, but on that point, I mean, we're not unique. I'm thinking Florida, California, there's other places in the country that have had, you know, huge mobile home communities that have reached their life? And is there any history to learn from other parts of the country as to how do you transition from, you know, a community that is past its, you know, lived past its sustainability into something else? Any thoughts on that?
I'm sure there are case studies that are available that could be researched. It is a difficult problem because you're dealing with a unit where you really can't rehab it probably. If you try to do it, you're just throwing your money away. So it is a difficult problem, and I'm sure we haven't done the research on it, but I'm sure there's case studies on other locations, like you said, that we could focus on.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Freeman.
Before we switch topics,
yes.
If I could.
Sure.
I just want to echo David's sentiment. I think that that's one of the biggest issues that our city is going to face, so whatever you guys can do to address that problem, I would completely agree with him.
Thank you. Let's go Mr. Freeman and then Mr. Thompson.
Thank you, Ruth and staff. And, you know, Councilmember Luna brings up, I have some mobile home parks that were built in the 60s and early 70s, and they're in deplorable condition today. So I think we're already reaching a maximum level with like Mesa Royale. So what we did is we reached out to the property owner and the general managers, and kudos to code compliance because they stepped in, they went into the general manager who had power of attorney to work in for the property owner. And so they're going to be enacting and helping clean up. But I think the next step is what's available resources for those, that ownership, to have better manufactured homes than what they're living in today, because they are deplorable. You know, and I'm going to switch gears just a hair here, but I appreciate Councilmember Haredi and I meeting with you earlier this week, and because I had some ideas and thoughts, but I think on the 2040 plan, it's important that you interface with the other departments to ensure the guidelines that are being addressed in the 2040 plan, because I don't know if we have cross communication between all departments, because it's been frustrating for some of the residents and organized groups to get information and their input thought into what is happening or has happened in some of the older areas of Mesa. So when we do the build outs and the infill projects, just that interface with current buildings that are there today is important. And then integration of the sub-area plans that we have throughout our community. We have sub-area plans, and they have specific thoughts that they would like to be addressed. And then I can't remember what slide it was, but applying more monies towards homeowner investment and partnerships or refurbishment of properties, I think, is important. Like Councilmember Thompson talked about, he likes, and I agree, that we should have more home ownership and maybe allocating more monies to those programs than what we are today, because I think you've maxed out in some areas. Is that correct?
Mayor, Vice Mayor Freeman, we have a set amount of money. We also have additional monies that council has that's part of the general fund as well. So it's not that we've necessarily maxed out. It's that every year, based on the priorities of council through our CDBG funding process, we prioritize where we're going to spend those monies. So, you know, for example, if based going through this process and when we meet with you one-on-one to really look at those goals and strategies, we want to make sure that we're listening to you and that we're figuring out where we're going to prioritize that funding. So, for example, if we're going to do more home ownership and rehab, perhaps our dollars allocated to rehab need to be realigned. So we could come to you and really give you a sense of where we're spending our money today and where you would like to prioritize those funds.
That's fair. I think also maybe how we can integrate that with these aging mobile home parks and if any monies are available for them to access that if possible.
Yeah, I think, Mayor and Council, I think we've looked into that. It's difficult because the CBG with capital, the homeowners don't usually own the land underneath the mobile home, and I think that creates a significant barrier to using federal funds. And that's what creates a significant problem for even doing the rehabilitation, the whole issue of the ownership, right? Typically, as I understand it, the ones we've looked at in the past, you know, the individuals may own or have some ownership in the unit, but not typically the land in which where it resides. And that complicates, well, federal funding is almost impossible because of that, because of the requirements of the federal guidelines. So, but we can kind of see if there are other programs to assist them to move to other locations where they could have better housing. I mean, the idea is here to improve the condition where they live and try to see if there's other options too.
Chris, on that point though, and could the CDBG dollars, since it's, because I know there's pots that you can utilize for the betterment of the community as a whole. Wouldn't that be seen as a betterment of the community as a whole? No, or is it because of the private land ownership?
Yeah, that's the difficulty. And remember, council, and I can't remember, what's our number for CDBG today? 3.12, mm-hmm. Something like that?
Yes.
Well, now there are some dollars set aside for housing, rehab, and we do that. But, you know, CDBG, now you're competing against all the public services and the homeless. So one of the things we need to do, I'm not saying we can't do anything, it's just that I think you have to be very, at some point you have to kind of be very specific and have a very specific initiative, because what we're finding as we're going through our experience with CDBG, this idea, and we're going to come to council and to our committees, is it doesn't help us and it makes it very difficult to administer, and we find some challenges with CDBG and the auditing process when we try to spread these funds like peanut butter across a lot of different areas. And frankly, the smaller the amount to one agency creates the highest liability and risk to the city. And so what it would be helpful is, as we think about these programs, we're not going to be able to address everybody. We're going to have to be kind of pick a specific area and project where we could think it provides the most leverage, and then kind of, you know, attack that for a couple of years and then move on to something else. So just as you think this through, we do, and I appreciate the council's kind of direction, because I think it helps us to kind of get this in a very tight package, because in the past, as we've been bombarded by a lot of, and there's a lot of needs in the community, so that makes it very difficult, right? But as you get a lot of different individual groups coming to us with a lot of different housing projects, it does create a significant liability for the city as we try to spread this out across a lot of different groups.
Yeah, I guess my feedback is maybe we can just look at the policies and procedures and make sure that what's going on, it will.
Yeah, and I think with these programs, especially the manufactured homes, I think the council just has to be careful as we get requests to expand these or to extend them. We need to give a critical eye to that. And because it's difficult the way they're established and managed today and how their corporations, a lot of these are outside corporations, is what we allow for them, how we allow them to continue into the future.
Thank you.
Kevin?
On this topic, do we have the ability to create any form of like ordinances that set age requirements in some of these parks? Because it seems to me that when these parks start to degrade, they start as 55 plus communities, and then it becomes an all age community, and then it slowly just becomes an extremely low income housing community. Like, is there an ability to set standards through any type of ordinance or zoning?
So, Mayor and Councilmember Whitaker, there is a zoning district and we haven't done it for many, many years, that you can do an age on the zoning district, as I remember, but I don't think we've done it for many years, and you have to do it at the initials, you have to do it at the beginning. Most age restricted areas are now done by CC&Rs, and so I'd actually have to look and see if that age zoning is still even in the state statute. So our powers to sort of, many of the restrictions now are in the CC&R, so it's not even the cities that's making that restriction. And if I may, if I could go back to what Councilmember Luna stated, part of the solution, and you said it earlier, was the unique relationship that we've had with CPLC. And I'd like to say, and I know you've said it, thank you to them. And what the, and really we should look at partnerships with them or entities like them, because what they did is they really converted one of these facilities into an apartments, and I believe they're also townhomes, and I can't remember if they're condos or not. And then by doing that, then they're able to tap into the federal money. And so that has been very successful, and they've been great to work with. And so we really should look to work with them or other entities like them. They're really unique, though, and so I'm not sure if there are other really entities like them. And so hopefully we can continue that partnership with them.
And to further note on that, that is one of the guiding principles, is to continue to seek partnerships to leverage housing development. So that would tie in directly to that overriding principle.
And I just want to make sure that I want to first say thank you to Mark for bringing up the home ownership. That's a horse I've been beating for 5 years, so I'm glad somebody else brought it up finally too. I think we have to, as a council, we also have to remember that our city functions off of sales tax, so we have to be very strategic in how we look at implementing a housing plan. We need to make sure that that our low income 38.5% low income in the city. We certainly don't want that number to grow by any means, or the 17% that are in poverty. We hope that we can lower that number as well. And I said it before in our meeting, and I know it's a dirty word, but gentrification, I think, is okay in certain areas of our city. I think it infuses private equity into areas and can be the one tide that rises all ships and creates that mix of housing that we really want to create across Mesa, instead of focusing all the low income just in one area. I think, you know, overall, Mesa still has, I'd asked a real estate friend of mine to pull some data for me. And looking at Mesa across the board for home ownership in the for-sale market for housing, Mesa is still just in the East Valley. I just asked her to look at Tempe, Chandler, Gilbert, Queen Creek, Apache Junction, Mesa. Mesa is still the lowest next to Apache Junction for housing cost. And so I think it's imperative that we also work with our neighbors around us to also take part or at least challenge them in developing their general plan and their housing plan as well, so that they have a mix of housing, diversified housing for residents, instead of Mesa being the place for all your low income or workforce housing to be developed. I think it should be, again, the peanut butter approach. You know, let's spread it across the East Valley and make it equitable for everyone instead of just Mesa. And that way, maybe we can see our low-income rates decline and then help the betterment of our city thrive into the future. So that's all I got.
Thank you. Couple of questions. Thank you for the. I think what you need from us is feedback on this slide and whether or not we endorse these five principles that you've suggested, you know, to guide your going forward. And I guess I get stuck first on number one, which is to expand housing throughout Mesa for persons of all incomes and needs. Yes, I recognize that we do need absolutely to expand housing, but what is the right mix of residential housing in Mesa? I mean, do we, decades ago, I guess we might have been characterized as a bedroom community, you know, a place where people lived, but they didn't necessarily, maybe the employment numbers to housing ratio wasn't what we wanted it to be, and that was part of why we were enthusiastic about annexing out, you know, in the Williams Gateway area and saying, okay, this is where our jobs are going to be, and that'll help us balance the ratio. But obviously we're going to continue to grow, and we should invite new people to live here. But I think as we quote-unquote expand, you know, unlimited expansion, or what is the sweet spot in terms of resident houses, rooftops, to other things that we need in our community? So I'm just curious as we go forward. I would endorse number one, but I would say, and I'm not sure what expand means. You know, what's the ratio of residential to other types of uses? Any thoughts on that?
Yes, thank you, Mayor. Well, that ties with making sure that we're working with planning and the general plan sets forth that mix. And then we, of course, need to promote a mix of housing in all different parts, in all parts of the city, and that will include market rate apartments for those that aren't ready to buy a home, executive housing. It will include affordable units for low and moderate income, because that is continues to be a great need. But there, you know, townhomes and condos, people that want to buy a first home that can afford something that's a little bit smaller. So we are going to need a mix of all housing for, so that 3,000 units per year that is our ultimate goal. But of course, we will come back to you and give you a little bit more with goals and strategies that would kind of go under those. Mr. Minks, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, I don't know if there is a right mix. You know, you can look across the valley. Scottsdale, for instance, you know, looked at as a very good community, wealthy community, has a high level of multifamily development, and they're intensifying even more. So I think it's really taking a look at what you have and whether you feel it's appropriate, whether you're providing the housing for all the people in your community across the board. So I think it's something that's very nebulous at this point, and something you have to look at and determine if you are doing a good job in providing housing for all the people in the community.
Yes.
Thank you, Mayor. Staff will also, in this next phase that we'll be going into, when we bring to you the goals and the strategies, we'll be working to create some maps that takes the data that Mr. Meeks has given us as a platform and overlaying, so that we can provide you some maps to really see where the housing stock is, where we feel that there's going to be areas to grow and initiate our strategies. So we will be giving you a lot more visual data along with the numbers that we've provided today and the baseline that Mr. Meeks has given us.
Great. And I guess that's part of my expectation as to why we have a housing master plan, is to help us know, is growth just unlimited, or is it, you know, we want to have a measured approach, right, to the growth that we have?
So I think, Mayor, you're speaking to an issue about residential versus employment opportunities is one. That's one issue, right? The balance. And we're always very concerned about the erosion of converting non-residential into residential, where we lose the opportunity for employment development, especially along the freeways and other areas. That's certainly one concern. I think the intention of this bullet, correct me if I'm wrong, is to suggest a more balance of the different types of housing throughout the city. So you don't only look at the west side as having a certain type of housing directed to a certain income, and other parts of the city, Northeast Mesa, only find a mix of a certain type. I think that was the intention of this bullet, or no? Am I misreading that? Because it says expand housing. I don't know if we're talking about expanding housing or diversifying housing by income and needs throughout all the city.
It's both. Thank you, Mr. Brady. So as you saw when we went through how the anticipated growth, that we're assuming is from all walks of life, all different needs, all different income levels, and they will want to live in all different parts of the city, depending on where their job is or what have you. So it's both. It's getting ready for those that are coming and making sure it's all different kinds of housing for them. So it's a very broad statement, but we wanted to make sure we included.
So we'll have to adjust. We'll have to bring in this conversation, though, to your point, Mayor, is the mix of how much residential you want to have versus non-residential, because I think there is a concern that we are more weighted towards a bedroom community than a job center community. We need to make sure we address that as we develop this plan.
Yes, and so I think this discussion is good for you to know that we do a broad interpretation of bullet point one is fine. We want it to be diverse housing, and we want there to be additional housing. But I think it also has to be a, this is a strategic plan, right? So yes, as per our previous discussion, we make more money the more people that live here. That's why we do censuses. But at the same time, the more people that move here, the greater the demand on services. So there's got to be, it can't be unlimited. It's got to be, we have to understand what is our capacity to be a quality community. So I think that is somewhat encompassed in bullet point one. But yes, Mr. Thompson.
And I'm glad you brought that up too, Mayor. I think it's, you know, going back to the diversity of housing, you know, and looking at our median income of the city, I used to meet quarterly, now it's about every 6 months with the management company that oversees Superstition Springs Mall. Every time I meet with them, the first thing they ask for is, how can you, in this area, how can you decrease the average age by 10 years and increase the average median income by 10,000? And those are things that our businesses in the community, throughout our community, need to survive. And so that's why I think having that diverse mix across the city and not stuck, you know, just shoved or keyholed into one location or pigeonholed into one location is a good idea. Because we really have to look at, I think, the demographics across our entire city to make sure that you don't focus or concentrate all of your low income in one area, because you'll see businesses leaving that area when you have people without expendable income that can afford to go shopping or to buy the appliances or what have you, and those businesses go elsewhere, and we want to keep them in our city. So we really need to focus on how do we diversify not only the housing, but those median incomes across our entire city.
So returning to the bullet points here, number two, that the current inventory of housing is healthy, maintained, and safe. I think that reflects back to some of our earlier discussion about the concern about the mix of aging manufactured housing. And to me, I think we do need to set this would be one of the biggest takeaways of this document, is what is our plan for dealing with the deteriorating quality of the manufactured homes in our city. And I think I might be supportive of saying, unless the industry can come to me and say, hey, yes, our older products are not are bad at this point, and we can have it, we can say at a certain year, we're cutting off, you know, moving these homes around anymore, and those homes, as they become uncompliant with our code, they're going to need to be removed. And they're not going to be replaced with homes of a similar vintage. And if the housing, the manufactured housing industry can convince us that the materials that they use now are as good or better than brick and mortar and stucco and sticks, then why would we, be biased against them? My mind is open on that. But right now I'm not convinced that the manufactured housing is a sustainable way to go in our future. And so I think we need to consider reducing the amount of manufactured housing and figuring out a way, looking at case studies from other states as to how do we transition these, you know, 30, 40, 50 acres of manufactured homes into something that's going to be sustainable and not a problem going forward. So I look forward to the plan commenting on that. And maybe we need to engage with the manufactured housing industry to convince us otherwise, because that's my concern. And then the slide slide eight. I know we, as Mr. Brady mentioned, I know we distribute right now millions of dollars of federal HUD money, but I just want to make sure that. As your statistics indicated, we are a community that needs a lot of help, and so I just want to make sure that we're maximizing the federal funds that we're receiving. Is there anything we can do to get more housing choice vouchers or to have a larger home investment partnership program? Or are we fully utilizing the emergency solutions grants? You know, how are we doing as far as maximizing the federal money that comes to Mesa? Did you know if is that something you can address, or is that something that we, I would like to see it addressed in the document?
Yes. So what we can do is what we're planning to come to you, and I didn't get to that last slide yet. So our next steps will be to be meeting with you one-on-one during November so that we can bring forth to you the goals and strategies. That's kind of like the detailed work of what the Housing Master Plan would have. And that's when we're going to outline all the plans. We want to give you a sense of how we're using our federal dollars today. And then based on your priorities for the housing plan, what are some ways that we could maximize the federal dollars that we are receiving to allocate to those specific priorities? We'll bring that to you with more detail, Mayor and Council, and to make sure that we're listening to everything that's being said today, and we'll make sure that everything there is included with our menu of strategies that we're going to bring forth to you. And then we will consolidate all that, put that in a draft master plan, and then on December 5th, we have scheduled to go to the Cultural and Community Development Committee. And there we will have that discussion to review it. And then we plan to bring forth a final draft to Mayor and Council for all of you to review and discuss at the beginning of mid-January.
Okay, great. Yes, Mr. Whitaker.
I have a question on that slide 11 again, when we're talking about the guiding principles. And it goes back to the question of what type of housing that we're building. Do we have a current inventory of our apartment stock versus what neighboring cities have as a percentage of their housing? Or do we have an inventory of houses under $200,000, houses between 200 and 250, 250 to 300? And are we comparing that to our neighboring cities to make sure that we're not overbuilding a more lower income housing or stuff on the lower side that's actually attracting people from neighboring cities, right? And I guess that shows my ignorance to the housing concept, but it would appear to me on the face that if we build a bunch of low income housing and apartments, that we're just going to draw that population away from neighboring cities. So I guess that's my question, is how does this compare to what other cities are doing? Because if we're overbuilding, I got to imagine we're pulling away that population, which leads to the poverty rate increasing in our city, right? If that's what we're actually attracting for our future growth.
Thank you, Mayor and Councilmember Whitaker. Part of the analysis that Mr. Meeks and his company had provided to us was an inventory of housing, the homeowners that were purchased, years, price range, and did compare that with some of our comparable cities. We will work more closely with planning to make sure that we have the inventory with apartments and add the additional years from the data that Mr. Meeks has collected, just to make sure that we can give you that exact data when we do return to you in a month. But we did make sure to be thoughtful in comparing the inventory with our surrounding cities, and also taking an inventory of the permits that are pulled through the planning office, what types of housing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm asking more of a question too. I'm not a housing person, I'm completely ignorant to the topic, but it would appear to me that if you build lower end housing, you're gonna attract that from your neighboring cities. Is that something that you would agree with, or am I missing a perspective or something? Am I missing something?
Yeah, Council, it looks like you're looking at me to answer this question. It's multifaceted. So what I mean by that is you have to look at your population growth. You have to look at the income level to really come, because right now we're talking about housing affordability, which is 30% of your income. So you compare that also to your job growth and the projected income of your job growth to really match the housing needs that are going to come out of that. And then with that, you also have to provide setting zoning designations that are going to be supporting the type of housing that are going to be built into those areas. So it's really comprehensive or holistic way of looking at it in total, rather than just focusing on one specific area. And right now, the good thing is we are having these conversations. We are really working with
the community development group, and we are also evaluating our general plan, because one of the requirements for our general plan is we have to evaluate it every 3 years. So we have meetings coming up to discuss how we can attack or address all these issues holistically, because I know one of the major conversations that is coming up is how are we also protecting certain areas, especially non-residential areas? How do we balance various land uses in the city? So we are looking at all that, and we'll be working with them to address it.
But Mayor, Council, I think Councilman Whitaker raised a really interesting question. I think Councilman Thompson addressed it to some certain degree. When we run these statistics, right, on poverty and income levels for Mesa, it would lead you to believe that, you know, we have this housing problem, which could be true. But part of the challenge is, too, is we're the most affordable community in the valley, practically. And so, to the point, we become the place where people can choose to live and a lower at a lower cost than most other cities in the valley. And so I think when we make decisions about do we want to continue to grow that part of our housing stock, but does that fulfill a need, or does that just bring more people from other places to Mesa for that? I think we need to have the right balance. I think if you look at the scale of the types of housing, you could certainly argue we have some areas where we have much lower older homes that are much more at the lower end. Well, and certainly since the recession, I think we have to be careful with statistics, since this recession, yes, those prices have increased significantly, but also where they started was very depressed also. And so, Council, I would suggest too, as planning brings to you these zoning cases where we're pushing back on a lot of these high density developments, it may not be necessarily always an apartment, but it could be something looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, but they're really tight, they're really small, they're high density. You know, the question is the sustainability of those in the long term also. So it begins there, right, when the council receives that. And I think it would be good as we're having this housing discussion to even kind of elevate it to that part of the discussion, as we have a lot of requests coming into you from developers who want to, maybe they're not always infill, but sometimes they're infill in other green, other areas, but they're really trying to squeeze the densities into these locations. And I think we have to be very careful, because it is in an effort to maximize value for the developer, but it also keeps those costs down low for the individual homeowners. So it's just something it's not just on the affordability side, but it's just the whole mix of housing throughout the city.
And I think, Chris, that, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, it's one of those where, you know, we complain a lot about our median income across our city, and we go through these woe is us because we're such a poor city compared to our neighbors, but then we invite that in our housing stock. And so if we ever want to, we either have to stop complaining about our median income and just live with it, or we have to do something about it. You can't have it both ways. You can't complain that your median income is low compared to your neighboring cities and then invite that type of housing into the city so that you can continue to complain about the median income again. So if you want to raise your median income, then you have to raise your cost of housing. And as Mesa continues to be one of the most affordable places in the valley, we really have to look at that. What is that tipping point to where we become or we force our neighboring communities to do more instead of just always being Mesa?
Frankie.
Yep. So I think my point in a couple discussions around, you know, planning and the priority number five as far as ensuring how internally we can you know, better plan out these developments that come in or requests that come in. And looking, you know, we look at planning a lot, but also looking at transit, you know, things like the huge development at the Union, at the Riverview complex. How do we look strategically on how do we set ourselves up for folks that can work there, but also live here, shop here? You know, so, like, looking at comprehensively when these large, both commercial you know, when economic developments are landing these large commercial buildings with a lot of employees, looking at our housing stock, looking at our transit options, how do we create placemaking opportunities for folks to stay in the areas connected into Mesa, not just come in and go out. And so just this, I think it's an important opportunity for us to delve in and be intentional on how these both commercial and housing requests come in, and how do we look at that comprehensiveness of building out certain areas where these requests are being landed. So I that's something I've struggled since coming on the council, just looking and working internally together with various different departments. And so the intentionality of that piece, I think if we can do a better job on working that in, or just for me to understand a lot better on what's being talked about. It seems like there is conversations going. If we can have more of that, those concepts, bridging various different key departments together, and how do we create opportunities where commercial and housing are coming in to keep people here in Mesa, since we're relying on sales tax. We want to make sure people eat here in the city. And shop here. So we want to make sure that we are connecting these requests together as we move forward.
Thank you. Well, I think on the agenda is to provide some direction, and I think that's centered around slide 11 here. And I appreciate, I know you have prior to this meeting met with council and gotten feedback, and this document has kind of been redrafted a couple of times. So I appreciate the effort you put into this. Council, is it fair to say the consensus is that we are okay with slide 11 as a going forward, that it reflects our priorities and provides the direction we want to give? Okay, great, thank you. I know this is the beginning, or mm-hmm. kind of the middle, so we'll look forward to have this beginning of the end. Yes. Okay, we'll look forward to meeting with you again. Thank you for your work.
Thank you.
The next item on our agenda, item 1C, is to hear a presentation and provide direction on proposed adjustments to non-residential utility water rates and a new proposed utility assistance program.
And there, we've already done that. The utility assistance program, did that a couple weeks ago, so this
right.
is just the first part of
that.
Okay, great. Good morning, Mayor and Council. Jake West, Water Resources Director. With me this morning is Seth Weld, our Deputy Director of Enterprise Services. Eric Hansen, our management assistant, has been the architect of these rate strategies and these adjustments that we'll be talking to you about this morning.
Great. Mayor, Vice Mayor, Council, we're here to present proposed rate changes to the Water Resources Department's water program, more specifically, proposed changes to the water program's non-residential customers. We'd like to take your guidance on these rates and as they pertain to the impact to our customers. We'd then like to incorporate these changes to our much more comprehensive presentation on October 24th. At that time, we'll also include a discussion of our residential customers who make up 90% of our customer base. We're going to be discussing that other 10% today. However, as of this year, that other 10% now consumes the majority of our water. So this proposal would impact those customers. First, we're proposing to bifurcate or split that general non-residential customer class into general and landscape service classes. We're also proposing to increase the non-residential general usage charge with no increase to the service charge. Of note, we also want to make sure you're aware that this would also apply to our large commercial customers as well, applied in a similar manner. So first, let's talk about that new landscape service class. We are not proposing, from a rate perspective, to differentiate yet between the non-residential landscape service class and general service class. However, it would set the table for us to eventually explore moving that non-residential landscape rate closer to the residential landscape rate, which is set at tier two of our residential usage charge. Now, that tier two is where we define the difference between necessary or life-sustaining and discretionary use. It'll also allow us to more effectively implement some strategies in our new drought management plan, more specifically those strategies outlined in stages three and four by sending price signals more for those discretionary uses. So the impact to our typical landscape customer, or the proposed impact to the typical non-residential landscape customer, that typical customer would be a commercial landscape customer using about 44, the median usage would be about 44 kgals or 44,000 gallons a month. Effectively, their rate increase for that typical customer would be less than 4.5%. And that would be achieved through a 0% increase to the service charge or that base charge, and a 6% increase to the uses and usage charges or an excess usage charge. Now, the general service class, that other service class, as we'll talk about in 2 weeks, we're currently not going to propose any rate increases to our residential customers. As such, this proposal would move the non-residential general usage charge closer to that second tier. Again, our current non-residential usage charge is the same as tier one of our residential usage charge, again, which we define as that line of demarcation between a necessary and discretionary use. So the impact to that typical customer, the typical customer would be a typical general commercial customer. They would use 11 kgals. So this is more that interior water, not the landscape water. Their effective increase would be less than 2%. And that would be achieved through a 0% increase to the service charge and a 6% increase to the usage and excess usage surcharge. Of note, you'll notice here the impact to this customer is much less than the landscape customer. That's because the landscape customer uses more water, and because we're only addressing the usage charge this time around, our customers who use less water would be less impacted through this proposed rate change. And then finally, our large commercial customers, we only have two customers on this rate right now, with a third likely to join back up at the first of the year. Again, our large commercial customers would see a 0% increase to their service charge and a 6% increase to their usage and excess usage surcharge. However, unlike our other customers, because these are such high usage customers, the median customer using about 11,000 kgals a month, they would see the majority of that 6% increase to their water bill. So with that, that concludes our presentation.
Thank you. Mr. Thompson.
Jake, how would these rates impact someone like CMC Steel? I mean, they're a huge water user in our city. I want to make sure that we're not, you know, harming them, and all of a sudden they start going, wow, we can't afford to stay in Mesa, not only for encroachment, but all of a sudden our rates are going up too. And, you know, we certainly don't want to lose them and companies like them. So how do we, what does this do for them? I don't know what their usage is. I'm guessing you guys probably do. Just out of curiosity.
Mayor, Councilmember Thompson, kind of an approximation. It's difficult to get you an exact because of the excess surcharge that comes into play, but kind of in a round number, it could be around $1,000 per month additional to a customer of that size.
But Mayor, Councilman Thompson, one of the reasons we're doing this is we have not adjusted this rate. So they've actually, for quite some time. So, and CMC still kind of moved into the rate recently. Are they in the large one now?
It was their expansion.
Their expansion.
Their production.
So One of the reasons that we've brought these to the council is in the past, I forget how long some of these rates have been around, probably this one was probably set about 4 years ago, somewhere along. We have made the adjustment since we actually created the rate, whereas on the residential side, we've made those adjustments. So when we went back, we realized we hadn't been addressed. We'd been focused very much on the residential side and creating the different tiers to try to get to their kind of basic water use. And then as we said here, then we're trying to get to tiers where we could distinguish between kind of your, what was the word? Necessary and discretionary. So we spent a lot of time the last couple of years trying to get those rates separated on the residential side so we could really help people be aware of their water usage, right? And so we didn't do that on the commercial. So now you see us coming on the commercial. So we've not touched a lot of these rates for a long time. So we'll do a lot of notice and let them know that it's coming. But these very large users put a huge demand on our system, right? And so we know we've got some others coming online, and we just felt like we needed to get this in front now because literally not only do they put pressure on just, the variable cost, but the plants, right? We know that, and this whole system. And so we figured we need to do a little bit of catch up. And so that's where this is coming from, is just to try to get it caught up kind of where we've been moving residential. We now bring the non-residential along at the same time.
Well, and I like the idea. Just I want to make sure that our businesses aren't all of a sudden like yikes and leaving.
Yeah. We'll share.
I like
with
the discretionary, increase on the discretionary side, right? Because that's usually their landscaping and stuff like that. And that really promotes water conservation to the businesses that otherwise would, have their nice green lawns and everything else, especially when we just signed on to the drought contingency plan and pushing that forward. So I don't mind the discretionary. Yeah. It was the...
We're just trying to be balanced. But we don't need can we look at the water consumption and where the commercial is? We don't want to overburden the residential side. And so this is where we're trying to get to.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
Mr. Thompson, also, that's part of the strategy why we didn't do anything with the service charge, because that's that base number every month that kind of gives us our equitable. But so it's basically going to be based, these rates are going to be based totally on the usage, not about, because the larger the meter, the more your service charges, so where they're not going to get double dinged. Also, I need to add that we've been watching this for a couple years now, but this is the first year in the history of Mesa where our general commercial customers are now using more water than our residential. So that's what we're trying to address. Is like Chris said, they're putting a lot of pressure on the system, especially these large landscape users that are using the water. So we're trying to just kind of balance that out because we are sensitive to the residential rates.
Thank you. Mr. Freeman?
Why not? Do you, how many customers in this 6-inch line or tier group are there, do we have in the city? And this is a question for me, is like, if you tiered off your 6-inch and your 2-inch customers, how many would there be? And
I'd have to get back to you on
that's
that.
That's fine.
But historically, from the last 4 or 6 or 7 years, we've been kind of working on those meters because a lot of them are 40 years old and they're not working accurately. So we've got an extensive program of getting those meters out. So I'd say we're in the hundreds of meters that are anywhere from 4, 6, and 8 inch meters, but I can get that data for you.
That's fine. I was just curious, but if the meters aren't working properly, we need to get them tuned up.
We're working on that very diligently.
That's another presentation that's coming
to you.
I'm a fan of this proposal. I think as we know, staff is not suggesting an increase in our residential water rates, and I think, we are out of whack, I think, on our industrial and non-residential rates. I think this is something other cities are doing, and I'm glad to see us following suit. I think it allows us to shift stress away from our residential ratepayers, particularly the low-income residential ratepayers that we're concerned about. We all know that we have a different model around here as to how we finance city government. In 1945, when the city council abolished the property tax, and in 2001, when the voters abolished the food tax, I mean, we are very dependent on utility revenues around here to make things work. We could be criticized for that model, suggesting that that's a regressive way to fund a city. That's a regressive fee or a tax. It's and our low-income folks are paying a higher percentage of their income for essential services than others, and maybe that's not fair. So I think we need to be very mindful of that argument in as we set rates across the boards in our city. And so I think this proposal is very sensitive to that. It's also good, I think, to remind all of us that we are sensitive in the way that we price our water, very mindful of the low-income residents, the Tier 1 folks that you talk about. That's an affordable water rate. And so folks who rely on water, low-income people, to stay alive, we do everything we can to make that as affordable as possible. But where we are in the business of selling utility, selling water, and that's how we finance our city, we need to see the industrial users as an opportunity to generate some revenue. So to me, this proposal recognizes that, and I support it. Yes?
I know that we do the residential comparison cost to other cities on an annual basis. Have we done that with the, I haven't seen any reports or anything on the commercial customers comparison to neighboring cities, where I think we do like Gilbert, Chandler, Tempe, Phoenix, right? Does that exist somewhere?
Mayor, Councilmember Whitaker, we look at the data. We have not produced that report, but we could certainly do that.
Okay, that would be great. Is it just oversight that we don't include our commercial customers in our annual rate increases, or is this something that we'll be doing moving forward? Is it the plan to start analyzing commercial rate customers and then adjusting those rates on an annual basis like we do with the residential customers?
I think at this point, now that we got the residentials kind of in the right tiers, we'll look at them all together. I think it was just a matter of trying to get focused. And so I think this time each year, we'll be reviewing rates on all classes of users and bringing those to council.
Okay. And I wasn't even aware that we weren't adjusting water rates for commercial when we get those annual reports. I assume there's only two buckets, the residential and what we're seeing today. There's no other like missing buckets of customers, right? No.
Residential and non-residential.
Okay. And did I hear you correctly when you said there's only two customers that fall under the large commercial? Is that
correct?
And do we have, I know that we've set up some complex legal structures when we do some of these agreements with our heavy water users. Is there legal hindrances to where we can't actually raise the rates on some of our customers because they're locked in? No, there's nothing. Okay. And if I heard you correctly, will we be hearing back from you guys on residential water rates on the 24th? Is that correct?
No, the only changes we're proposing for residential is the reduction, I guess that's the right word.
Low income
senior reduction. That's what we'll be bringing to council on November 4th. So that's what we'll be, you'll see that in November, right? We've covered that. We talked about that as part of the whole, how we're trying to address the public assistance, the utility assistance program. And that was one of the proposals that the council, I took direction that you were endorsing. And so what has to happen with rates, and there'll be one more group of rates discussions that'll come with you on gas and electric. Today, we just wanted to cover water. So we have, I think November 4th is the date we're scheduled. We're leading up to November 4th because then the council has to take some action to actually give notice that you're going to be making rate changes, like the ones you're seeing here today, as well as reducing the one for the low-income seniors. We have to do that notice on November 4th so that the rates can go effective March timeframe. Is that about right?
January.
Okay. Take action in January. Okay. So there's all these multiple steps to do rates. So we're just trying to lead you up to that point. We'll probably we need to have a presentation on the electric and gas. Now that may affect some residential, but again, our marker on residential for gas and electric is to stay competitive with SRP or Southwest Gas. So that's where we'll be with that on the water. We're not proposing to make any adjustments to residential on water or wastewater. We can do the comparison of the other commercial entities and utilities across the valley. Again, as we do that, it's kind of like the residential, and it's like we've presented to the council is, you can't look at Mesa in a silo of just the utility rates, because it's directly linked to the fact that a business may be in Mesa paying a little bit higher on their commercial rate, but for them, the big benefit is there is no primary property tax for them. And so that's certainly, we hear that from these companies that we're talking to. They recognize that's certainly a benefit to them. So that's part of the trade-offs that take place. On the residential side, it's they don't pay a primary property tax and they don't pay a sales tax on food. And so as we've seen, when you take all of those things in consideration, Mesa is a very affordable city compared to almost any other city in the Valley.
So on that note, Chris, I think when we do the residential comparison, we actually do a household estimated cost, which includes the fact that there's no property tax, the fact that we have the secondary property tax, gas, water, utility. It takes into account the entire picture, right? So, I mean, couldn't we do the same thing?
No, it doesn't work that way, because what it doesn't show is that what we collect as far as sales tax of a city per capita is the lowest in the Valley. It doesn't show that what we collect in property tax per capita is the lowest in the Valley. So what the point is that if you isolate it that way, you miss the point. It misses the picture that the available resources that the city has to fund local governmental activities is the third lowest in the community. Because if you only do it in that kind of parsed out way, it skews the fact that there are communities that have, certainly they can keep their utility rates low, because they've got tremendous amount of sales tax coming into their community, not just from their residents, but it's being imported. So they have a much more, on a per capita basis, their available resources to fund local government is significantly higher from us, and they could be a population much less than us. And we know that there are communities that maybe they don't call it a general fund transfer, but they charge a cost per meter that goes to their general fund. Tucson actually has a fee that goes directly to their fire department. So everybody does it differently. And so the easiest way to normalize this across the board is just we look at how much revenues does each community have available to fund local government and divide that by the resident. And that gives kind of you can look at it per resident, per capita. And that's how most of these analyses are done. To be able to compare. And again, we are, it's very difficult for us to imagine, not having these revenues, because we are already at the lowest end of the scale on affordability.
So I guess the report that I'm referring to is the one that the budget office traditionally gives us on an annual basis. It takes into account the property tax, the sales tax, water, wastewater, solid waste. It takes into account all of those variables, right? And then it breaks it down by household. I guess I'm just wondering, on the commercial side, can we get that same comparison of, because one of your comments was, well, the commercial customers come to us and they say, well, or we go to them and we say, well, you're not paying a primary property tax, therefore we're allowed to charge them a higher utility rate, right? So I guess I'm just saying, where do we have a report or something that shows their cost savings on property tax versus their higher utility rates, right? The
well, we can't estimate their primary property. We don't know what their primary property tax is. especially in commercial side, that is, data centers have legislation that gives them tax breaks on a variety of different things. But it is something that comes up in the discussion. And so, I mean, that's real. I'm in those discussions. We can run it the way you're looking at it and the way we've done it in the past, but we realize it doesn't provide the most larger view where Mesa stands as far as available resources. So the homeowner survey is not very beneficial in really understanding how it impacts Mesa as far as the resources we have. And the fact is, we are the most affordable city, one of the affordable cities in the Valley, even with the transfer. We include the transfer in there, and we're still, lower than most of the cities. It's just that we do not, kind of going back to the previous conversation about low income and housing, we're just not collecting the same amount of sales tax per resident that our neighboring cities are. Not even close. We're at the bottom of the chart. And then what this really comes down to is how much the cities have to pay for local services. We're the third lowest in the whole city. Even with everything you want to count in here, that's taking all resources, that's taking the CAFR and looking at it. So to me, that's the simplified way to really synthesize what we're trying to talk about to a resident is say, listen, you're paying less from all sources to local government and Mesa than you would, you know, any other community in the Valley.
Yeah, I just, you know, the report that I look at, I mean, it shows the average annual household cost when you account for everything.
Right.
Property tax, sales tax, water, wastewater, solid waste, Mesa's $2,297 per household. The only city that charges more than Mesa is Glendale, and every other city in our comparison chart is lower per household cost. So I agree with the way that we've been doing it in the past. It's a great way to analyze what the true household cost is for citizens of Mesa.
Well, you're looking at cost, and I think that's one way to look at it. But that, unfortunately, if that's the only way it's looked at, I think it skews the picture that someone in Mesa would think that the cost of government is higher than it is in other places in the Valley. And that's not true. Mesa provides services to each resident at a much lower cost than almost any other city in the Valley. And so if you know, the analysis you're doing doesn't attribute, the fact is that when you look at it for the number of residents, if you take the 500,000 residents across the city of Mesa and the resources we have available, we provide that at the lowest cost. And I think that's what the residents want to hear. At the end of the day, yes, you may be paying more in utilities, but you are paying less in local government than any other city.
Let me bring us back just a little bit. I think we do have an e-session still on the agenda for today. I think the question before us now is, do we want to provide direction on going forward with the rate increases for non-residential?
We'll just bring these on in November, Mayor, unless someone tells us otherwise.
So we're not actually taking that action today. We're providing direction to staff, saying we like the direction that you're going. We look forward to you coming back with specific proposals that we'll vote on at a later date. And I for one, I think would like I say, encourage the direction that you've presented us today. Is that the consensus of the council? All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate it. The next item on our agenda is item 2. That's to acknowledge receipt of board minutes. Is there a motion? Thank you, Mr. Freeman and Mr. Thompson. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. Passes unanimously. Item 3 is to hear reports on meetings and conferences attended. Council, anything you'd like to share with us?
Yeah,
Mr. Freeman.
Thank you, Mayor. You know, this morning I attended a temporary breakfast over at Fire Station 201. I don't know if many ate there, but it's Fire Prevention Week and had a great breakfast. So got there about 6:30 this morning, and Fire Prevention Week. So check your smoke detectors.
All right. Thank you. Anything else you'd like to share with us, Council? I know we. I will share the fact that here is a proclamation I was proud to sign, declaring this month as Domestic Violence Awareness Month. You may notice that we're wearing purple. We'll be participating in a photo immediately after this meeting. Some of us are to promote the Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and there's various activities throughout the city on that topic this month. So, very mindful of that very important topic. Mr. Brady, what other meetings do we need to be aware of?
So, Mayor and Council, we're giving you a lot today, so we will give you a break on the 17th. So we will not meet on the 17th, because we would just be reviewing the agenda. So our next time we'll meet will be Monday, October 21st. And this is going to be a very important meeting because it's just going to be Mr. Pombier leading the way. So I'm sure you'll have a great. He's not even here today. We gave him, told him, we sent him off to boot camp,
yes,
so he can be ready for it. Just real quickly, this Saturday morning at 8 a.m. at Pioneer Park, we'll be celebrating the designation of Pioneer Park as one of the great public spaces, one of the 6 great public spaces that was recognized by the American Planning Association. So the mayor and others will be out there receiving the certificate and celebrating this during the Mesa Farmers Market in Flea. So look forward to that.
I hope people hear that the American Planning Association designated Pioneer Park not as one of the six best parks in the United States, but as one of the six best public places. So that's a very big honor. We're excited to accept that award this Saturday. Council, if there's nothing else that we have, is there a motion to convene an executive session? And this is for the purposes of pending litigation case Johnson v. City of Mesa. Thank you. And a second. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
I will convene an executive session.